Well, here we are on the fifth day of the feast. I did say at the beginning that it wouldn't last long. The 1,000 years will probably go along at the same sort of speed. We'll probably always be running late, and we'll probably get it finished just as the hand comes to the 12 o'clock bit on the last day. Today, what I would like to do, I'd like to give you some idea, I'd like to paint a picture as to what it's going to be like when those people return. Because, you know, in the past, I think we kind of think of the millennium and we immediately think of the Garden of Eden, which, of course, is the whole purpose of the millennium. But, you know, it's just not going to be like that to start with. In fact, it's probably going to be an awful lot rougher than any of us could think. And the interesting thing is, I want you to keep in mind as I go through this, we are going to be there teaching, directing, and guiding these people. Because they're doing the physical work. Some of the work I think we will do, as we'll see as we go along, I think there's going to be some recreation. Because we totally perverted everything in this society. I mean, where would you go to get cattle to take into the millennium? Right? Virtually all the cows on the planet, apart from a few little organic herds, where they really do eat grass, they're all being fed pellets and protein and fish this and I believe even cement or concrete or something they put in the food, I believe. It's ridiculous what they feed. And then they wonder why everybody's getting allergies. We will probably have to do some recreating, that's for sure. And then Mr. Bowles will have his wish and he'll get to see the magic code. And he can sit there for hours and hours playing on a spiritual computer. As long as he doesn't start doing any drag and drop experiments. And Christ gave us an example of that. Think about it. How else would you design a duck-billed platypus? I mean, that was put there just to throw the evolutionists completely off their stool. Think about it. It's got a poisonous barb on its back legs. It's a marsupial, so it carries its young in a pouch, and yet it lives in the water. It's got a tail that looks. It's a complete drag and drop thing. And yet last night we saw that video, and we looked at those birds. And I mean, it's. If anybody can watch that video and then turn around and say, that evolved, even one tiny bit of it, then all I would say to them is this, I wish I had your faith. If I had the faith in God that you have in your crazy idea of evolution, I could relax, I've got it made. Seriously, that was really a wonderful video. It's going to be hard work though at the beginning of the millennium. From a transcript from Mr. Armstrong's sermon 1983, round about the feast time, Kidnapped was the title. So then came the Feast of Tabernacles, the 1,000-year reign which Christ after he comes. Satan will be put away and we'll begin to have peace in the world. Notice he said, we'll begin to have peace. Now peace isn't going to come immediately at the beginning of the millennium. I wonder if you realize that. It's going to take time. It will take 2 or 3 generations because the world will have to be re-educated. I had to look at that twice because he also uses the word de-educated as well. And there's one thing as an educator, having started 3 colleges or being used by God in starting them, I have learned that it is about 10 times harder to unlearn error and false beliefs than it is to learn something new that you have never known before. The world is going to have to go through a period of unlearning, of getting rid of false conceptions, of false ideas, of false philosophies, of false concepts of life, and what it means, and what life is all about. We just had it just now in the sermonette. They're going to have to use the fact that when they build, the building's got to stand for 1,000 years. Those buildings they build at the beginning of 1,000 years will have to withstand 1,000 years. Okay, the atmosphere ultimately will clear up, so there won't be the atmospheric problems. Then the earth will probably be quite stable, I would imagine. So it won't be having huge earthquakes and so on. And the weather, say, will be nice. So, yeah, but they'll have to be built. We have a church down the road from us that's almost 1,000 years old.
almost 1,000 years old.
And it's still a good, strong, solid building. What's it built out of? Stone! The walls are about 4 foot thick. Tremendous. So, let's keep this in mind. This is Satan's world. All of it, every single aspect of it, down to using pine to make a door. In 10 years' time, that door will probably be replaced if it lasts 10 years. If it lasts 10 years. The millennium is going to be totally, and I can't stress the word totally enough, totally different in every aspect. I don't we even realize yet just how different. Hopefully today we might start to, you know, get a bit more of this into our heads. Now we're going to go through the book of one chapter of the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel 39. Now, Ezekiel's a strange book, and Mr. Armstrong explains. Basically, the man to whom the book was given, he wrote it down, could never, ever, ever deliver his message. It was totally impossible. Mr. Armstrong, in writing in the Pastor General's Report, September the 5th, 1979, he says, "Years ago I proclaimed on the air a great deal from the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel was among the Jewish captives of the 604 to 585 BC captivity by Babylon of the kingdom of Judah. It was more than 125 years after the kingdom of Israel had been invaded, conquered, and moved from Palestine to Assyria on the southern shores of the Caspian Sea." Well, think about what was 135 years? What was the world like 135 years ago? The late 1800s. Completely different to today. "That both the Assyrians and their slave Israelites had long migrated northwestwards into Western Europe and Britain when Judah was made captive by Babylon." So the whole world situation had completely changed. Ezekiel's message was not to the Jewish slaves among whom Ezekiel was living, it was to the house of Israel. And he quotes Ezekiel 2 verse 3 and 3 verse 1. But Israel was nowhere around, so it must be for us today. The prophet Ezekiel was never able to break loose from Babylonian slavery and proclaim his message to the kingdom of Israel, then dwelling in Western Europe and Britain. So the message of the book of Ezekiel is for us today, so that we can learn a lot about the millennium right here. So first, what we have to understand is that the section of Ezekiel, that's chapters 37, 38, and 39, are a reverse prophecy. To illustrate that God uses this method, is another example from the book of Isaiah. And if you turn to Isaiah 65, we see in verse 17, this is much easier, just going clip, clip, clip. You start at verse 17, and it's talking about a new heavens and a new earth. If you drop back down to verse 21, it's talking about the millennium. They'll build houses and inhabit them. They'll plant vineyards and eat the fruit thereof. The wolf and the lamb will feed together and so on. The lion will eat straw like the bullock. And the dust shall be the serpent's meat. And they shall not kill, hurt, or destroy in all my holy mountains, says the Eternal. That's obviously the millennium. Drop down to 66 verse 5. "Hear the word of the Eternal, ye that tremble at his word. Your brethren that hated you, that cast you out for my name's sake, said, Let the Lord be glorified, but he shall appear to your joy, and they shall be ashamed." So you see that it's written in reverse. Now, why did God do this? He did it that way because the only people that could possibly decipher these scriptures are the people that understood God's plan. It's only when you understand God's plan that you can understand Ezekiel 37, 38, and 39. Because 37 deals with the Valley of Dry Bones, which is the last great day. 38 is the second time that Gog and Magog come up against Israel, against the unwalled villages. And 39 is the first time at the return of Christ when they're there. So with that in mind, let's just start into Ezekiel then. Let's start in Ezekiel 39. Ezekiel 39 and verse 1. "So you, son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, Thus says the Lord God, Behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Misha, and Tubal. Now, Mr. Armstrong, in The Plain Truth in May 1986, in an article entitled, Why Russia Will Not Attack America. Very interesting, because we have a situation right now, don't we, in Syria, where we have Russian warships and American warships all lining each other up, one protecting Syria, one wanting to blow up the smithereens. I doubt there'll be any problem there, because that's not where the action is designed to be at this time. Europe is more involved, and Russia will be involved, as we see later on. Mr. Armstrong says, note the allies who come with them in this future battle. You will find Gomer, Togarmah, Magog, and Meshech. Tubal identifies in Genesis 10 with the sons of Japheth, father of the Eurasians. Ethiopia and Phut, or mistranslated Libya, are descendants from Ham. The area covered includes Russia, India, and China. Interesting to note that these three are drawing very close together through trade now, aren't they? But you see, when Mr. Armstrong wrote this in 86, who was China? They were still having Mao Zedong and these cultural revolutions and slaughtering each other by the tens of thousands. The country was a mess. It was just coming out of all that mess. And yet today we look at China, and it's kind of different, isn't it? Kind of different. Very different. And China and Russia have got more trade agreements than you can shake a stick at. China's put men in space. How have they done it? They've done it with Russian technology. But what has Russia got back from China? Well, China's got all the American technology, haven't they? I believe that China is actually manufacturing the actual airframe of one of the US fighter jets. Now, you know, that is really clever to have a potential enemy involved in the production of your weapons. It takes some real skill to work out how to do that, I don't think. Verse 2, I will turn you back and leave but the sixth part of you, and will cause you to come up from the north parts, and will bring me against the mountains of Israel. Then I will knock the bow out of your left hand and cause the arrows to fall out of your right hand, and you shall fall upon the mountains of Israel, you and all your troops and all the people who are with you. I will give you to birds of prey of all sorts and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. You will fall on the open field, for I have spoken, says the Eternal God. Not somebody you want to mess around with. I will send fire on Magog and all those who live in security in the coastlands, and they will know that I am the Eternal. This is a phrase that appears all the way through the Old Testament, if you think about it. Because people don't know. When will they know? They'll only really know when the Holy Spirit has been poured out on everybody. Then they'll understand. Then they will know. Then they'll be able to go back and look at the history and say, whoa, why didn't we see that? It was obvious. It was absolutely obvious. And the classic one is the Second World War. Germany caused all the problems. So when the war was over, Russia made sure they got a good slice of Germany, and they literally ripped every industrial plant out of the country. It was all dismantled and taken over to Russia. They left East Germany, and basically it's a farming nation. Very little industry at all left. What does America do? They get the Marshall Plan, and they rebuild Germany, leaving Britain with bombed out steelworks and all the rest of it. Even up until the early 60s, they were still using the similar type machinery that was used before the First World War. In fact, in Helsham, where I lived, Helsham was the centre of rope making in Britain until about 15 years ago. And some of the machines, you could see where they'd been converted from manual power to steam power, and from steam power they just put in the electric motors, and the original machinery that was built back then, built, I might add, with a good deal of quality, yes, still running, because it wasn't designed as we heard in the sermonette, that it's got a design life of 50 years ish it's like that washing machine you buy, it's guaranteed for 3 years. When does it go off? 3 years and 1 month. We've had so many products do that on us. They've got the distinct design life. They get that. Okay, so you all have got to enforce the following laws, right? The design life is 1,000 years. Get your head around it. It's got to be quality. And we just heard there in the sermonette, and I mentioned the other day too about the bricks, the stones that went into the temple. Manufactured to tolerances that we would badly even do today, and even then, still covered in gold. Absolutely, just can't get any better. Now, the interesting thing is here, he said, so I'm verse 7, so I'll make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel. So that's one of the reasons why Gog and Magog are treated like this. It's because when the Israelites come in, as we'll see in a minute, they've got to clear up the mess. And we're going to show you how big a job that's going to be. He says, so I will make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let them profane my holy name anymore. Because they'll have God's Holy Spirit, and they'll understand why God's done what he's done. They'll understand who they are, and they'll start to understand where they're going and where they fit into God's plan. It says, then the nations shall know that I am the Eternal, the Holy One in Israel. Why? Because everybody's going to know about this. You can't slaughter 166 million people in the quiet backwater. The whole world is going to know about it. Verse 8, surely it is coming, it shall be done, says the Eternal God. This is the day of which I have spoken, all through prophecy, I might add. That if Israel didn't buckle down and obey God and live God's way and enjoy all the blessings, he would ultimately have them taken into captivity. It happened back then physically. It's going to happen again in our age physically. It seems almost unbelievable that the nation of America is going to be totally destroyed, that a third of the people are going to die in the war. War. Attack. It'll be all over before it starts. Another third will die of the famine and the pestilence. And the other third will go into captivity. And they'll be decimated as well. And the same goes for Britain and the Eastern European nations, which who are the Israelites of old. It's hard to take in as we sit here. And you're sitting there in Kentucky. And you can just jump in there and you can go down to... is it Woodson Bend there? And buy your liquor now. You don't have to drive out of state. What a privilege. I bet you the bank owns the liquor store. Is any profit to be made? The bankers are in there, yes. It all seems so solid, doesn't it? You know, you go out of Kentucky there, you drive over that great big steel bridge over the part of the lake there. All solid thing and gone down in all the rows and rows and rows, miles of shops seem to go on forever. It looks very solid. You fly over America, city after city after city after city. 300 odd million people, only half of whom I might add are Israelites. Point to keep in mind. It's going to be destroyed. And it's going to be destroyed very, very soon. Maybe a little bit sooner than people think. This warning is throughout Scripture, but few have ever understood. Verse 9. Then those who dwell in the cities of Israel will go out and set on fire and burn the weapons, both the shields and the bucklers, the bows and the arrows, the javelins and the spears, and they will make fires with them for 7 years. And we'll cover this a bit later on. They will not take wood from the field nor cut down any from the forests, because they will make fires with the weapons, and they will plunder those who plundered them, and pillage those who pillaged them. So a little note here, it's very hard to burn an AK-47. And you won't be able to really get a tank on fire to do a barbecue, will you? But there will be huge quantities of fuel left behind. An army this size, there'll be enough fuel to last 7 years. Diesel doesn't really degrade that much, as long as it's genuine diesel. And we'll cover that bit a little bit later on. Verse 11. It will come to pass in that day that I will give Gog a burial place there in Israel, the valley of those who pass by east of the sea. And it will obstruct travelers, because there they will bury Gog and his multitude. Therefore they will call it the valley of Hamon Gog. Why? Because there's going to be a highway go from Egypt all the way up through Israel, all the way up through what is today Turkey. And Turkey will be totally annihilated because Esau will not figure in the millennium at all. And that road would then go all the way across to Germany. I worked it out on Google. It's around about 2,500 miles. Why? Why a road? Well, you can almost bet that road's going to go up somewhere near this valley. And every time anybody goes past, they're going to look near the... That's where they are. That's where there's tens of millions of people buried that dared to stand against the God of Israel. Quite amazing. These things are all done for a reason. And they're done all the way through because he says, then you will know that I am the eternal your God. I am in total control. Absolute total control. And verse 12, for 7 months the house of Israel will be burying them in order to cleanse the land. Starting to get a picture now of that first job that these people are going to have to do. Verse 13, indeed all the people of the land will be burying, and they will gain renown for it in the day that I am glorified, says the Eternal of God. A bit King Jamesy, that, isn't it? More modern translation says, yes, all the people of the land will be burying them. They will become famous for it. It will be a day for me to be glorified, says the Eternal God. Why? Because the whole world will understand that an army of 200 million came against Israel and they were completely destroyed by God. Now you think about it, today we have armies. There aren't very many huge armies. Most countries, even like America, they've probably got around about 1 million people in the military from all three services. But you start looking India, you start talking China, you start talking Russia. You're looking there at 2/3 plus of the world's population. That's a lot of people. That's an awful lot of people. There are more people on the internet in China than America, times 2+. I believe one company alone has got 600 million subscribers. But then they've got 1.3 billion people. That's why all these companies have wanted to get into China. I go back to the old story where back in the 18th, and this actually happened, by the way, in the 1800s. One of the companies that make shoes sent a salesman down to Africa, and he came back and he said, well, forget it, there's 150 million people and not one of them got a pair of shoes. And that was it. And a few years later, they sent a real salesman down there, and he came back and he said, there's 150 million people and not one of them's got a pair of shoes. What an opportunity. That's the China today. They're gaining and they're growing and they're getting more and more money and suddenly they want a car. And the top Chinese, they don't want a Vauxhall. They don't want a Ford. They want a Rolls. They want a Porsche. They want a Mercedes. They want a Bentley. All good German cars, by the way. We don't make them anymore. Well, we own the factories, but still British workmanship, but no longer owned by Britain. In England, if you bring something new onto the market, you've probably got a potential market of several million. But you bring something new onto the market in China, the numbers are astronomical. That's where the profit is. That's where the bankers have taken all the industry, because that's where the money is at the moment. But what they don't realize, what they've done, is they've taken all the industry there, and they've given China, in the last 50 or 20 years, the technology to take over the world, frankly. And they've left Britain and America as service nations. We make our money in this country by robbing... Oh, sorry, not robbing everybody else. I get it wrong again, didn't I? But by helping them by banking and controlling financial circles. Like robbing them blind, basically. And America's not far behind. They manipulate things and so on. It's all false now. It's all facade. All these new jobs in America, they're temporary jobs. The full-time jobs are gone. Why? Because the factories are gone. You've probably all seen Detroit. It's just gone bankrupt. It was once the most fabulous city in America. It was rolling in it. I mean, the center of the motor industry was there. Now it's a great place to go and get lovely photographs of derelict buildings. Verse 14. They will set apart men regularly employed with the help of a search party to pass through the land and bury those bodies remaining on the ground in order to cleanse it. At the end of 7 months, they will make a search. So in other words, it will be the initial 7 months when just about everybody, I guess, will be out there cleaning up. And then after that, there's going to be specific people allocated as jobs to still go throughout the land and look for remains. And they'll put a marker there, and then the crew will clean up, the crew will come up behind, and they will take those bones or whatever's left of them and dump them in this grave. The search party will pass through the land, and when anyone sees a man's bone, even a bone, he shall set a marker upon it till the buriers have buried it in the valley of Hamon Gog. The name of the city also will be Hamonah, which means multitude. Thus shall they cleanse the land. Verse 21, I will set my glory among the Gentiles. All the nations shall see my judgment, which I have executed. You see, all the way through, God's drumming this point in to us. Because let's be honest, when we get to this stage, we're going to be it. We're going to be God. A lot of what I'm talking about, we're going to be organizing as teachers. Verse 22. Oh, what a surprise. So the house of Israel will know that I am the eternal their God from that day forward. From that day forward. Nothing more convincing than looking over a land that is simply wall to wall covered in dead bodies of the people that stood against your God. That gives you then the idea that, hey, if he can do that, there's just nothing. Nothing that God cannot do. The whole world will know why all this tribulation happened to Israel. And they will understand that Israel are God's chosen people, and that if they want help, they will know where to come. You see, the nations originally were supposed to do that. God's idea was to take his nation, Israel, put them in the promised land, and make that country a jewel, so that the nations around could look and say, wow, we want some of that. And you know, even to this day, I remember Mr. Armstrong saying that in one of the interviews he had with Mrs. Golda Meir when she was in charge of the country, she said to him, she said, you know, it is so frustrating. If these Arab peoples would just come to us, we could help them. We could show them technology where they can get water. We could show them irrigation schemes. We could help them with planting. We could help them with other technologies. We could help them medically. She said, but frankly, we could bring them out of the Middle Ages. But they will not come. Even in this era, that happened. Israel was supposed to be the model nation. After all, the great God was their God. And everybody would look at this. Now let's face it, if you came into that nation back then, and you got to look at this temple with those two great magnificent columns at the front of it, and then this building behind, and the gold and all the razzmatazz going on around a bit, you'd look at this and think, well, there's some real substance here, isn't there? I mean, you look at an American city, an American skyline, you look at these skyscrapers, they seem to go on like endless. It just oozes wealth. Now, at the moment, in many places, of course, it's actually oozing decay. But it's the same in any big city. That Israel was supposed to be the model nation, but they fluffed it because they would not obey God. And God warned them, and he warned them, and he warned them, and eventually you have several prophets that came before Israel was taken into captivity. And strangely enough, I'm still studying this a little bit, but it would seem to be around about 80 years that they were warned, which is rather an interesting thing, because in January we come up to the 80th anniversary of the first broadcast of The World Tomorrow. And in February, it will be the 80th anniversary of the very first Plain Truth magazine. And you can go on the internet and you can find that, and you can see the cover. And the headline, if I recall it almost perfectly, it says, "Will a dictator arise in Europe?" See, Mr. Armstrong had that revealed to him over 80 years ago. And we've just had Mrs. Merkel safely ensconced as the leader of Germany. Because the leader that we're looking for to come in Germany will only come out of a crisis. It will not come out of a meeting of any parliament or any lawyers or whatever. There's a crisis coming, and that will take care of the leader. So, you know, we all continue on. But the world should have focused on Israel. And what do they do instead? Today, Yankee go home. Yeah. You talk about America to a lot of Europeans, and the attitude is, ah, well, just open another barrel of dollars and we'll solve the problem. And that, unfortunately, has been the attitude. And in spite of trying to do good, everything they try to do good is taken the wrong way by other people. And, of course, the whole thing is now going downhill at a ridiculous speed. Verse 23, the Gentiles shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their lawlessness, iniquity, lawlessness, because they were unfaithful to me. Therefore I hid my face from them. I gave them into the hand of their enemies, and they all fell by the sword. In other words, God's hand was taken off them. And when you look at what's going on in the world today, I wonder, has God's hand now been taken off the nations of Britain and America? Because there's some crazy decisions being made out there right now. The logic has gone. We have a Gentile ruling in America, which is totally forbidden in God's word. And with respect to the leaders in this country whom God has put there, they're all young men who have never held down a real job. What experience have they got to go back on? Our Prime Minister comes out some mornings, evidently, and takes his child to the creche. So, you know, we don't have the statesman. But then it says that in the beginning of Isaiah, I'll take away the statesman. I'll take away the great military leader. And who has it happened? I bet it's happened. God says, I hid my face from them. According to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions, I have dealt with them and hidden my face from them. That's your tribulation. And the only people that he won't hide his face from in the tribulation are those who eventually get the message and cry out to him for help. And then he says, you're up. The next few verses show the time frame. Verse 25. Therefore, thus says the Eternal God, now I will bring back the captives of Jacob and have mercy on the whole house of Israel. Britain, America, and the European nations that are all part of Israel. And have mercy on the whole house of Israel, and I will be jealous for my holy name. I will be jealous. Anybody trying to interfere with Israel, let's just say it's not going to be a very good idea. Because God says he's jealous of them. After they have borne their shame, and all their unfaithfulness, in which they were unfaithful to me, when they dwelt safely in their own land, and no one made them afraid, but I have brought them back from the peoples and gathered them out of their enemies' lands, out of captivity. Hard to believe today. You tell people, the nation's going into captivity, and they look at you and they think, shame. Pity we haven't got any mental hospitals left. The nation of Britain going into captivity? Verse 28. Why? Here we go again. Then they shall know that I am the Eternal their God who sent them into captivity among the nations, but also brought them back to their land and let none of them captive any longer. Every single captive that qualifies, every single captive that is not a rebel, because they'll all be sorted, will be brought back to the land. So God's telling us right here, by the hand of a man who had no chance to ever deliver his message to the people that he thought it was intended to, that is to us today, he says, I will put you into captivity, I will bring some through the captivity, and I will bring them back to the land. I will not hide my face from them anymore, for I shall have poured out my spirit on the house of Israel. Here we go again about Joel, isn't it? The people that we will have to work with right at the beginning, they will have God's spirit, and they won't have Satan. They'll be shell-shocked. They will have come through 3.5 years that we can't even get a head around. And the Bible just says, look, it's a time of trouble, the likes of which there has never been or never will be again. That's how bad it's going to be. And we all know the atrocities that happened in the Second or First World War. I mean, that was the dumbest war of all, as far as I'm concerned. Two nations facing each other on the Somme. Somebody blows a whistle, and all the British guys and the Allies get up, and they run across the field of the Germans, who mow them down with a machine gun. And then there's a truce, and they go and collect all the bodies, and they come back, and then the Germans jump out their trench, and they run across the field, and the British mow them down. When they had slaughtered 1 million men, somebody said, I don't think this is a very good idea. How dumb can you be? And you know the man who solved the problem? Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill drew the rough designs for what became known as a tank. The tank was originally designed with just machine guns on it. And its sole purpose was to trundle across that open piece of land with all the bullets pinging off it. And when it got to the other guy's trench, they'd just rip down them with machine guns, and they'd go on then to the second trench, and they'd rip down with the machine guns and so on and clear the land. That's what broke the problem. Wonderful thing, war, isn't it? They're all going to be resurrected, those people. They're all going to be resurrected one day. Several million of them. And we come to the Second World War. We've got a bit more sophisticated now, you see. We can send 1,000 bombers over to Germany eventually and just totally obliterate, for instance, Dresden in a complete fireball. There was a hurricane wind created, evidently, by the amount of incendiaries they dropped on that city. 100,000 people were killed. And that was just one. But it was revenge for what they did over here, you see. So, you know, you bombed Coventry, so we'll come and bomb you. And this is how it all went on. And again, tens of millions of people lost their lives. And you think, well, that's pretty bad. And then you go into some of the things that happened in the Far East. What do they call them? They're up in Vietnam and all that area. There are all sorts of slaughters of billions of people going on. That's just in the last few decades. That is nothing compared to what's going to happen in very shortly. You know, when you start bombing, as Mr. Armstrong says, you start bombing major cities with hydrogen weapons, it's quite easy to wipe out 1 million-plus people at an instant. And if you read the Bible carefully, it talks about baldness on every head. Why? That's what happens after an atomic explosion. The hair falls out. And then sickness comes. And a whole load of people then die as a result of the radiation problems. This is coming to America. It's coming to Britain. We know it's coming. And tell them, and they'll laugh at you. Right, the first job for the returning captive. Let's just take a break now from Ezekiel. Let's turn to Zechariah 14. Zechariah 14, scripture we all know. Zechariah 14, verse 12. I remember some of the children wincing at this some years back, and some of them thinking it was really cool. And this shall be the plague within the eternal will smite all the people that have fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand on their feet. Their eyes shall consume away from their holes, and their tongue shall consume away from their mouth. So what will actually happen was, whatever happens there, the skeletons will be what drop to the floor. The rest is just obliterated. Now then, turn to Isaiah 34, because it gets a bit more interesting. Isaiah 34 and verse 1. Isaiah 34 and verse 1. Come near, you nations, to hear, and hearken, you people. Listen up, God says. Let the earth hear, everybody, all lot of you, and all that is therein, the world and all the things that come forth from it. God wants every living being to hear what he's saying here. For the indignation of the Eternal is upon all nations, and his fury is upon their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has delivered them to the slaughter. Their slain also shall be cast out. Their stink shall come up from all the carcasses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood. I don't think it's a good idea to be on the wrong side of this, do you? Horrendous. So what is going to happen here? Because on the one hand, You have some people where the flesh and stuff literally just is wiped off their skeleton. And yet we've also got people who are dead, and the bodies, the carcasses are lying there stinking. And it talks about, going back to Ezekiel 39, in verse 17, it says, "And you, son of man, thus says the Eternal God, speak unto the feathered fowl and to every beast of the field. Assemble yourselves and come, gather yourselves on every side to my sacrifice, that I do sacrifice to you, even a great sacrifice upon the mountains of Israel, that you may eat flesh and drink blood. You will eat the flesh of the mighty and drink the blood of princes of the earth, of rams, of lambs, and of goats and bullocks, all of them fatlings of Bashan. And you shall eat fat till you are full and drink blood till you are drunken of my sacrifice which I have sacrificed to you. So we seem to have two different stories here, don't we? We have some bodies lying rotting, sinking on the ground, and yet we have some that are just skeletons. It would seem that as Christ returns, that there is a blast that he hits this army with. Now, this is speculative, but if you put the two scriptures together, and another one we'll look at in a minute, it does seem to indicate that this is something like... Now, today we've got a neutron bomb. A neutron bomb is really nice. It's really cool. They developed them in South Africa, strangely enough. It was actually a shell, a very small nuclear warhead. And what you did was you figured out that in the bush over there, about 15 miles away, there were some terrorists, but you didn't know exactly where they were. So you lob one shell over, and you explode it at about 500 feet. And instead of a great big nuclear explosion, you basically have neutrons. So there's a small blast, but it sends out some kind of a force field, neutrons, that kill every living thing, except, I believe, a cockroach. They survive. But everything living, every animal, every bird, every lizard, is dead to within a 5, 6, 7, 8 mile radius, depending. And the reason I know this is my neighbor was part of the group that worked on this thing. He was one of the special forces. And it came out subsequently that it was developed in league with Israel. So you can bet your bottom dollar the Israelis have got this technology, because I'm talking back 1970s, early 1970s. But they didn't damage anything else. So then 2 days afterwards, you could just drive in and count the bodies. But the trees and plants and everything were still there. Buildings were still standing. Nice weapon. Today what we can do is we can take a hydrogen bomb and explode it 300 miles above the United States and fry every computer chip. Completely fry their whole electrical setup. No electricity. Planes would fall out of the sky. Your car would stop. Your electric kettle wouldn't work. The toaster wouldn't work. The cooker wouldn't work. The vacuum cleaner wouldn't work. They've all got chips in them, huh? Unless you've got one of these real old Frigidaire fridges that was made before the war. There's clunks away there and still keeps clunking away. But it took four men to lift it into the kitchen. It was so heavy because it was made to last. Not like the new modern ones that last 3 years and 1 month. Ezekiel 39, going back to verse 2, we read that. I will turn you back and leave but 1/6 part of you. A sixth of 200 million, it's 30-odd million people, you get the impression that these people were at the periphery of this blast. But they saw the result. They saw what happened, and God allows them to return to India, China, and Russia to spread the word. We went 200 million, we come back 30-ish million. And we saw what happened to the others. And the whole world will know, and the whole world will fear. They are witnesses. God always has witnesses. We are witnesses. We are witnesses that God is going to do what he says in this book at the end time. And we know it's going to happen because it was revealed through Mr. Armstrong. And as we live now, we can look back and we can see... Just in the late 40s, in Germany, he saw Germany was going to rise, when everybody else was looking at it as being a bombed-out place full of rubble. The Berlin Wall hadn't even been thought about, which wasn't until about the early 1960s. And Mr. Armstrong was talking about East and West Germany joining up, and some of the Eastern European nations leaving the clutches of Russia. The USSR had to be totally wrecked to allow that to happen. Mr. Armstrong saw that 20, 30 years before it happened. How did he know? Like I said, we need to thank God for the spiritual preparation that he has put into this feast. But we also need to thank God for the spiritual preparation he's put into his plan. We are witnesses of what happens up to the return of Christ and beyond. The apostles were witnesses of Christ's life, and they documented it. Bless them, we have it all written down. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the book of Acts, and all the writings of Paul, 1st and 2nd and 3rd Peter and so on. These are eyewitness accounts that we can know that that happened. We can go back and we can look at what happened at the fall of Judah. We can look at what followed even further back at the fall of Israel. Do you know why the temple was completely trashed when Babylon came? Do you know why not one stone was laid upon the other? Well, think about it. You've got this lovely big building, and everything's covered in gold. Underneath the gold is wood. And they torched it. It shouldn't have happened, evidently, but they torched it. And with all this timber, it burned, the gold melted, and ran down in between the brickwork. And evidently, the Babylonians just pulled everything apart to get the gold that had run down. That's what Christ said. Not one brick shall remain upon the other. They took it to bedrock. They took it to bedrock. So, the prophecy was fulfilled. And it was fulfilled because the house was built perfectly in the first place and covered with gold. That ensured it would be completely annihilated. Because of the value that people put on that gold. And they smashed up the two big columns, Jacob and Boaz in the front. They smashed those up and took that brass. It wasn't actually a brass as we know it. It was a non-tarnishable kind of, it looked like gold. That was all taken back to Babylon along with all the stuff in the temple. But you see, it happened. And we've got proof it happened all the way through this Bible. We are a part of the continuous, Mr. Armstrong said, basically we are a part of the continuation of the books of the Acts. I'm sure there will be. Mr. Waterhouse always said he felt that the Acts of the Apostles, there would be an additional bit on that in the millennium, which covered the Acts of this end time apostle. That's how important Mr. Armstrong's work was. Without the knowledge God gave him, we wouldn't know anything of this today. All came through him. And I don't care who it is who comes up with any ideas. I believe Glenn Beck recently came up with this wonderful idea that America was part of Israel. He could only have got that from one source. Sorry. Either from somebody directly linked to Mr. Armstrong or somebody that was teaching what Mr. Armstrong had revealed to him. Now let's have a look at the job here. If we're all involved, this is part of our problem. Right? Turn to Revelation. Turn to Revelation 9. Revelation 9 and verse 14. Saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year, to slay a third part of men. A third part of men. Now, is that a third part of the whole world population? A couple of billion, maybe? Or a third part of what's left by the time we get to this stage? Because a whole lot of people have died before now. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000, and I heard the number of them. Myriads of myriads. And at one level, you can question this, because you think, oh, come on. 200 million? That's a massive army. But you know, a sixth part are sent home, right? That's 33.3 million. They're lucky ones. They get to struggle home and tell everybody about their kind of like experiences. 166,000 need to be buried, right? 7 months is the job. 7 months. Now, if you take 7 times 30, because it'll be 30-day months, that's 210 days. Divide by 7, you get 30 weeks, 30 Sabbaths, so not the 30 Sabbath off, you've got roughly 180 working days. I mean, there's 7 months, you might be coming into the holiday season, maybe. But roughly 180 days, which means they got to bury 900,000 bodies a day. Now, we were talking the other night, and I thought, yeah, that's an awful lot of bodies a day. But then again, how many Israelites are there going to be? If there's 2 million Israelites, you know, it takes 2 of them to bury one body, doesn't it? it appears then that some bodies will even still remain. And they will continue to clean up the land for some time after this event. Ezekiel 39 again, verse 14. They will set apart men readily employed. So there was some people are going to be drafted and just say, this is your job. Fortunately, the land of Israel is not that big, but it's still a fair chunk of land when you've got to go over every inch of it. And they search all the passage. Yeah. The message to the people is the land must be totally cleaned up. This is going to be one of the most major operations ever carried out on this planet. And we are very possibly going to have to organize it. Yeah? So, we have our deacon, he's complaining about organizing 24 people. We'll see how he does when he's got to organize a few million. You get a bit of help there, Chris. Don't worry about it. I'll organize that for you. One thing is for sure. How do you feel those people? I mean, they're going to be excited at one level. They're going to realize what they're doing. They're cleaning up the last part of Satan's world. And boy, are they going to look forward to the Sabbath. Oh, can you imagine? When you come back to your groups and you get sat down and you can relax and then you can learn more about why you're there, where you're going, how we're going to live and so forth and so on. Now, there's two things here that come out. The first point is verse 10. They will not take wood from the field, nor cut down anything from the forest to make fires. That's one of the points that I find rather interesting. It talks about making fires of the weapons to plunder for 7 years. So let's deal first of all with the plunder. Here you've got this group of people. They probably got away with the clothes on their back. They've got nothing, no physical things about it at all. The size of the army, the plunder that would be left behind would be awesome. You see, it's not just a matter of clearing up bodies, is it? There'll be ammunition, there'll be shell cases, there'll be all sorts of tanks and stuff that we don't really want. I guess they'll be piled up in one place to be dealt with at a later stage, probably. But, you know, there'll be lots and lots and lots and lots of fuel tankers. Tanks use an enormous amount of diesel. An enormous amount. I mean, you know, you talk about gallons to the mile, basically. So there'll be lots and lots of diesel around. There'll be plenty of trucks of various sorts, and smaller, like jeepy-type vehicles and so on. How else can we do the cleanup operation? How else are we going to clean up 900,000 bodies a day without using some kind of vehicles? Got to do it. Can't be done by hand. It's carry all the bodies 40 miles. It's not on. 50 miles, 60 miles, depending on where they are. So we'll have to use. Yes, at the beginning of the millennium, we will be using equipment that is polluting the atmosphere. Shocking, isn't it? But think about it. You can then tell the people, this is not ideal. This is not the way it's going to be. This is not what you're working towards. This is just a temporary fix to get us through this period to where the kingdom can get established and then we can get things organized. We've got to have some form of technology. If you've got a highway going all the way from Egypt, all the way up around and into Germany, 2,500 miles, that is not being built to look good. It's not being like today, you know, one African dictator, you know, built himself a few miles of dual carriageway and he bought a big limousine, bulletproof of course, and the outrider and the motorbikes, and he'd have six guys going in front of him, all fully American uniforms, and he'd ride down this motorway, freeway type job, round the roundabout and back up the other side, and he'd wave to all the people, and he'd go into his palace, and he'd sit on a big ivory throne. Do you know who paid for it? Britain. We gave him £300 million, if I recall. And that's where the money went. It's designed to help his people. That's the way it goes, isn't it? Where were we? Yes. Yes. We were sorting out tents. Plenty of tents around. Big tents. Tents that maybe have been used to field hospitals, for instance. They could be used for Sabbath services. The weather is going to be benign. We're looking like a world that's been totally shattered. It's been knocked off its orbit. It's been shaken up so much with two huge earthquakes It may even have moved continents back into one huge continent. We don't know. The cities of the planet, all the cities are laid waste, it says. All of them. So, there will be accommodation. They won't have to have stone buildings all at once. They can live in tents. They can live in tents for years. Abraham lived in tents most of his life. So that's not a problem. They'll have some food that's been left, dried food, I guess, like rice and so on. We can go on and have a look. Basically, it's a matter of getting things gradually improved until we can get into God's economic cycle. Isn't it interesting? They can't chop a tree down for 7 years. 7 years is part of God's cycle. Every 7 years, it starts anew. You have 3 years, 3 years, and a year lying fallow, and then the eighth year you start again. So it looks like it could well be that the first 7 years is a matter of getting rid of all the garbage, cleaning everything up, getting people into the areas where they've been allotted land, and working with the soil. You see? See, I've got information you don't have. Marvels of modern technology. My wife was on chat room. I always get them all muddled up. And some lady said, yesterday in America, Mr. Bowles gave a whole sermon on trees. She said, I've never heard a sermon on trees. And I froze because I'm going to talk about trees. I've got a lot of information about trees, actually. But I better get going here. I'm not going to get through it all. I thought, that can't have happened. No. So we downloaded the file and I listened to the sermon this morning. And apart from two scriptures, it's completely different. I said the other day, didn't I, that the two of us could give the same material and it would come out totally different and yet it would achieve the same end. Now you've got a classic example here. Classic example. And I'll tell you something, when you finish that sermon tomorrow, you're going to have a lot more respect. When you add it to what I've got here, you're going to realize just how important trees are. Just jumping the gun a little bit, because later on, of course, we hear that the amount of oil splits in two, doesn't it? We have this water that gushes down. That happens empty straight away. I guess the temple is built over that at a later stage. Once Mr. Monroe can get his act together and start getting some decent stonework. Because that is going to be a beautiful temple. Because Christ is literally going to be in that building, right? But that little river, it says it's full of fish. Going back to Ezekiel 47, verse 6, Ezekiel, just a few pages back, it says, he said to me, son of man, have you seen this? And he brought me and caused me to return to the brink of the river. And he says, now when I returned, behold, at the bank of the river were very many trees on one side and the other. I don't have to go into this because Mr. Bowles deals with this a little bit. Verse 9. And it shall come to pass that everyone that lives and moves wheresoever the rivers come shall come. This rivers, by the way. Notice rivers. There's two of them to start with. But of course they'll branch out, won't they? There'll be little streams and tributaries going on. Shall live. And there shall be a great multitude of fish. A great multitude of fish. It even talks about verse 10. The fish shall stand on the Dead Sea, from Engedi unto Eglion. That's virtually from the one end of the Dead Sea to about three quarters of the way up. And this will be a place for the spreading forth of nets. You get the impression that in the millennium, fish is going to be an important part of a diet, people's diets. It should be today. The trouble is now, to get decent fish, you're paying more than you'd be paying for meat in many cases. And it says, fish, according to the kinds of the great sea. So we're talking about saltwater fish. We're talking about the great sea being the Mediterranean. So fish is going to be a major part of the diet. So they'll have plenty of food. They'll have plenty of food. And they'll be getting taught. And we'll be there. But just get the impression of the job we're going to have. We're not doing the work for them. Not all of it. We're doing some of it, by the way. You'll see that in a minute. We've got to do. There's something we've got to do. We've got to be involved even in healing these people. That's the first thing. That would be one of the most amazing things, to have lived through atomic explosions and all the rest of it, and then say, right, now you're here, the first Sabbath service or ever, you're all healed. Every ailment is gone, your body is back to being perfect, and it happens instantly. Can you imagine what people are going to be like? Somebody who was blind, somebody who's lost a leg, and suddenly the leg appears. or whatever. It's going to be a fantastic time. Maybe Christ will do that before when he reasons with them. It says he reasons with them, chucks all the rebels out. And he says, I will heal you. Now, is he talking about I as being him personally? Or is it the empirical I, in other words, the family? I think he'll involve all of us in a lot of this. So let's have a quick look at trees. Now, Ezekiel 39 verse 10 says, they will not take wood from the field nor cut down any from the forest. One of the most neglected parts of our environment today is trees. In the millennium, this will change dramatically. And when you say, when you put this little bit I've got with what Mr. Bowles is going to give us tomorrow, you will just realize the importance of trees. It is utterly, utterly bordering on the unbelievable. If you think the birds were fantastic, wait to see the trees. So, what's a tree worth? Come on, we're all a bunch of materialistic 21st century folks. It's got to have value, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, Michael Coons is an extension forestry specialist. He says, most people think of trees as having value that can't be expressed in dollars. They think a cool shade on a hot day, beautiful flowers in the spring, great fall colour, but he says there are other things. According to the Growing Greener Cities book published in 1992, see, they've known about this for a long time. The American Forestry Association, trees have significant monetary benefits. They have found that a single tree provides, this is in an urban environment, right, £73 worth of air conditioning, dollars worth of air conditioning, $75 worth of erosion control, $75 of wildlife shelter, and $50 worth of air pollution reduction. That's $273 or £170 per tree per year. If you look at the trees in New York alone, that's a lot of money. When I was in South Africa, I had my own business, and somebody said to me one day, do you use much timber? I said, well, yeah, use a fair bit. How do you like some teak? Oh, yes, please. How much? Free. I said, no. He said, free. All you've got to do is collect. And he gave me a man's name, and I went down to the docks at Durban. The Japanese, in those days, were importing cars into South Africa, ready-built. In a box. Literally, in a box. That's where the expression came from, down there. I've got a new car, out of the box. That's where the expression came from. It literally came in a timber box. And the timber was teak. Can you believe it? Not this cheap pine. Teak. The Japanese cleared square miles of forest to get this timber dirt cheap. And they were making boxes out, stick cars in. And they were at least 6 to 8 feet length with no nails in. And it was an inch thick. And the planks were between 9 and 12 inches deep. Oh, did I fill my poor Cortina up. Their springs were down the other way. I'd gingerly drive home, chuck it on the shed, back down again, another load before he changed his mind. What a waste of resources. Teak is one of the words that can, the woods that will last. Down in Rhodesia, when they were doing the railway, right? Some of the railway sleepers there, they're still there. Do you know why? They're teak. They took teak, one of the most valuable woods you can get, right? And they made railway sleepers out of it. Talk about wasting resources. Hey. Quantifying the economic value of trees to cities. Another article. This guy's been counting trees for the last 20 years, poor fella. And he comes up, he says, New York, for example, has 876,000 trees. Why? He's counted them. Covering 23% of the city. They provide $11.2 million in annual energy savings, have a carbon sequestration value of $386,000 and a pollution removal value of $836,000. Their asset value to be replacement is inexpressible. When we had our 30th wedding anniversary, my granny and I went and bought, we pooled our resources and bought Sheila, 35th wedding anniversary. We bought her an Acer, a Japanese maple, right, which is a real fiery burgundy red color. It's a real beautiful tree. It was one little stick
about 2.5 feet high.
That tree is in a tub to this day, 10 years later. It's now about 7 feet high and about 5-6 feet across. It's standing in our backyard, and when the sun sets on it, it just looks like a ball of fire. To replace that tree today, I would have to insure it for about £200 to £250. Mr. Bowles mentioned one of those English houses in his sermon, which you'll see tomorrow. We went to Nyman's, wasn't it? And they had them. Aces. By the hundreds. Hundreds. Every variety, shape, size. There was one that just looked like a huge mound. And you just wanted to touch it. You know, run your fingers down the leaves. It was fantastic. And you had others that were different colours. One was like, the leaf was green, going over to like yellow, and the tips were all pink. And it was just wafting in the wind. It was like swaying in the breeze. Absolutely stunning. That's just in one garden. Trees, very quickly. A whole lot of points about trees. Trees produce oxygen. Very simply, we could not exist if there were no trees. A mature leafy tree produces as much oxygen in a season as 10 people inhale in 1 year. So one tree supports 10 people. What many people don't realize is that the forest also acts as a giant filter. And what we're doing in Indonesia and down in South America is we are literally slaughtering forest by the square mile to plant rubbish to produce biofuel. The Victorians used to put aspidistra plants in their front room, which is where the gentlemen used to retire to smoke. And tobacco was regarded as a, you know, it was the weight. He had to be a man. He had to smoke. Why? Because aspidistras and ferns actually absorb so much rubbish out of the air. They take all the nicotine. They did some tests on ancient aspidistra plants, and they were lethal. They had so much nicotine absorbed into the leaves, into the very roots. Trees control noise pollution. If you live on the other side of a forest, you don't hear anything behind the other side. They can slow down water runoff. One Colorado blue spruce, either planted or growing wild, can intercept more than 1,000 gallons of water annually when fully grown. One tree. I know in South Africa that a lot of the farmers would put blue gum trees where there's a danger of flooding, because blue gums just suck everything out of the soil. Around blue gum trees, the ground is dry. They just send their roots down until they hit water. Any flood water just gets sucked up with them immediately. Trees store carbon. There's all this talk today about global warming. Well, one of the problems, apparently, the temperature, by the way, according to reliable sources, has not risen one bit in 15 years. It's a lot of rubbish. But there is a problem with carbon dioxide. The reason is, we're taking out too many trees. We're taking out the trees, and they can't keep up with it, so it's starting to build up in the atmosphere. They clean the air. They provide shade. They provide cool. They act as windbreaks. They fight soil erosion. And here's the big thing. I'm going to use a big word. I heard this once given in a sermon. I thought, oh, fancy using a word like that just to appear to be clever. We have a symbiotic. Isn't that nice? A symbiotic relationship with trees. We are living in symbiosis. That sounds good. Did you know you were living in symbiosis? I thought I was living in Hailsham. It means having an interdependent relationship. There is a symbiotic relationship between the bee and the flower. Oh, ye who believe in evolution, which one came first? Because the flower can't multiply without the bee, and the bee can't produce what it produces without the flower. There's a problem. The tree breathes in what we breathe out. We breathe out basically carbon dioxide. It sucks in the carbon dioxide, changes it into sugars, and I won't spoil Mr. Bowles' sermon tomorrow, but the tree uses a whole lot of that sugar for a very mysterious purpose. It uses that sugar to support the largest living organism on the planet. Now, I didn't know that. And you're not going to know any more about it until tomorrow, so you have to listen. It's fascinating. It's a lot more fascinating in some ways than a bunch of birds flying around. And then it gets rid of its waste product, which is oxygen. Oxygen. We have that relationship with the tree. What we breathe out, the tree breathes in. Ever walk through a forest? Don't you find it's really refreshing in a forest? Especially on a hot day. We've got some lovely forests near us. Beautiful. You just go in there, the temperature drops 2 or 3 degrees straight away. You normally get a little bit of a breeze, get the lovely smell of the different timbers. Fantastic. And the whole creation is interlinked. You have the birds that eat the bugs. You have worms that aerate the soil. Just wish that when Noah went in the ark, that he'd gone splat with a mosquito, and maybe splat with a couple of wasps as well, that we wouldn't have the problem we've got today. One thing Mr. Ball does cover, so I won't bother, he'll do it tomorrow, in Leviticus 19, God's got a law regarding the planting of fruit trees. It's got to be done one way. They go in, they have 3 years, nothing happens. The fourth year, any fruit produced is holy, and the fifth year, you eat. If they attacked a city back then, they could chop down normal trees to use in the battle, but they were not allowed to touch a fruit tree. Not allowed to touch a fruit tree, because that produced food. Sensible! Today, we just obliterate everything and turn it all into a waste. That would be really good. Trees are so important to the environment that God himself says, I will plant trees. Turn to Isaiah 41. Isaiah 41. Verse 18. Just notice the language being used here. I'm going to just emphasize it. I will open rivers in desolate heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool as a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar and the acacia tree and the myrtle and the oil tree. I will set in the desert the cypress tree and the pine tree. Mr. Bowles said that pine is possibly a mistranslation. It could be oak. Yeah, and the box tree together. Why? Why is God doing this? Could well be the empirical eye. We might be involved in this. It's not a worldwide phenomenon, this. It's not land, just in the land of Israel. That they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the eternal God has done this. The Holy One of Israel has created it. Why? Because trees are the lungs of the world. They absorb all the rubbish. They absorb floodwaters. They stop soil erosion. But most of all, they produce what we need to live. How important is a tree? He then goes into Isaiah 47, which is the other scripture I'm not going to bother with. He explains it obviously very well about why these trees are down both sides of this rivers. You've got to keep in mind that God's kingdom it's all about give. As other nations come and surrender their sovereignty, we will move in and we will do the same to their land as we've done to the land of Israel. I wonder if that seventh year, when people just live off the land, if some of the people won't be drafted into, say, Egypt or Lebanon or whatever, who is the latest country to come under the rule of God, and take with them the cuttings, and to replenish the earth, to regenerate everything. That's what the millennium is all about. It's a regeneration of all things, getting back to what it was like. You know, the restoration of all things. Are people going to live for the whole 1,000 years? Could well be. Because that's what it was originally. Could we have a 360-day year? You can prove that's what it was like before the flood. No question about it. The whole climate before the flood. It says there wasn't rain. It was watered by a mist. And yet we are then told that in the millennium there will be rain. But it would be the right amount of rain at the right time. Not just as the crop's ready for harvest and it gets rotten. Well, as I said, trees are the lungs of the world. In the millennium, they will be greatly valued. Just think about it. You see, it's time. In the Bible, it talks about, in, I think it's in Proverbs, it talks about that the parents should provide for the children.
And the children's children.
Right? How about you have your land? I mean, some of you older children, you'll go into the land. You'll have your land. You'll be able to get married, you'll have your children, but you'll also have this land. You'll be able to think, my children's 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 children, 200 years' time, I'll give them a present. Do you know what you do? You plant walnut trees. So all that 200 years, once they've gotten through the first 5 years, everybody can eat walnuts. And at the end of 200 years, when that tree is mature, the tree can be cut down, and you have probably the most beautiful, valuable timber on the planet of the earth. It's fabulous. If you can see a piece of real walnut, today it's almost impossible. You get what they do with car dashboards, they cut a wafer thin sheet of it to put on the dashboard. The grain patterns are stunning. You could plant an oak tree for your children's 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 children 600 years into the millennium. So they can cut that down and perhaps make some new furniture or replace some window frames. Because an oak tree, its life cycle, believe it or not, can be up to 1,000 years. Amazing. That's an English oak, by the way. It's amazing. Trees I hope you have a whole new concept of them. I just love going to some of these big gardens, and we go on around, and you see how these people, like Capability Brown, landscapes 500 acres with lakes, and of course in those days, you showed your wealth by the fact that you got these trees from all over the world. We had it at Ambassador College. Hugh, who built that place, he had trees from all over the world. We took them out of the ground and planted them all around the grounds as mature trees, and they all grew. Everyone, we never lost a tree. Fabulous trees. Dozens and dozens of them. The value of those trees would be, you can put a price tag on them. I mean, it's big trees. I'm talking trunks a couple of feet in diameter, some of them. We dug a trench around them, filled it full of peat, and left them there for 12 months to get all the new fine roots in. And then they had a really gentle way of doing it, this L-shaped thing against the tree, strap it all around the tree and get a hook at the top and yank it with a tractor. And it just literally ripped it out of the ground. And then we trundled it along to a pre-made hole. And in the tree would go, be an angled stake going to stake it up for the first few years. And every single tree was successful. They're all still there to this day. You can go and see them. Absolutely amazing. No, trees are fantastic. They're beautiful. A lot of them produce fruit. Some of them produce flowers. We saw a tree up there, was it about 50 foot high, covered in those big flowers. Unbelievable. And sometimes some of them, it's a smell. Like you mentioned about the cedarwood. You know, the old-fashioned wardrobes used to be always made out of cedarwood because it was known they killed bugs. And yet the smell, you open a cedarwood wardrobe that greets you is beautiful. Well, time to sum up. It's going to take 2 to 3 generations, as Mr. Armstrong says, to start turning around this whole thing. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time to start producing things to replace those old dirty, stinky diesel engines. Hopefully, within a few years, we can get rid of them. Maybe modify them to run something else. I don't know. But it will take time. It will take time for trees to grow and mature. And it will take time to get people to stop thinking in terms of jingle bells or silent nights or all the rest of them. They come around to December. Do you know what December will mean? You know, all December will mean, well, it won't be December, it'll be another name. But when you get to December in the millennium, it'll simply mean there's about 3 months to Passover. Or the feast was 3 months ago. It'll mean nothing. Absolutely nothing. The condition of the land, when these people arrive back, it's really going to rub it into them. This is the end result, again, well, we can tell them. This is the end result that happens when you rebel against me. Yeah? Because my daddy is bigger than your daddy. But he's now your daddy as well. Literally, daddy. Abba, father. That's the relationship God has with us. He will have the same relationship with them. He wants them in his family. So the first thing the family's got to do is get rid of every vestige of Satan's world. Scrape it off the surface. Tuck it in the valley and cover it up. Then they have 7 years of living off the land. Not to say there will be food, other food produced. But it's going to be a pioneering thing which came out yesterday. They will be the pioneers. To a degree at college, I was like that. I'm sure Sheila. The Bricket was just being built. There was no gymnasium, no girls' dormitory. The girls all lived in Memorial Hall. All these things had to come. The trees had to be moved. The lakes had to be dug. And it was just great being there because, you know, suddenly there was lakes. Suddenly there was a new building here and gymnasium over there. It was a great time to be involved because there was growth and things were happening and changing. It was wonderful. That's what these people are going to be involved in. They're gradually going to see all that old rubbish from this world all phased out. Whatever the new technology, there will be, there's got to be technology. You're not going to ride a horse from Egypt to Assyria. 2,500 miles. There's no way you could do that on a horse. Sorry. You're the surest behind in history. There's got to be some form of transportation. And why? Well, there's got to be trade. Why? Because all the nations are all linked up. You've got the Germans who are unbelievable as engineers. You've got the Americans who churn things out by the million. You've got the Japanese that can copy anything and still churn it out by the million. You've got the inventiveness of Ephraim and company. The world's going to be a fantastic place. All we have today all came out in the last 200 years. So what's it been like 400 years into the millennium? And all speaking the same language, which nobody's mentioned yet. I got that one in as a winner. The millennium is going to be totally different. People's outlook will be totally different. Final scripture, Revelation 22. Revelation 22. Verse 10. Revelation 22, verse 10. Remember, this is the Apostle John now taking down the last commands from Christ. And he said to me, "Do not seal the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand." Like 2,000 years later, right? "He who is unjust, let him be unjust still. He who is filthy, let him be filthy still. He who is righteous, let him be righteous still. He who is holy, let him be holy still. Behold, I am coming quickly. And my reward is with me to give according to every man according to his works. Blessed are they who do his commandments, that they might have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the gates into the city." And he's not talking about a city in the millennium. He's talking about the holy city. And that's the destination of at least the Philadelphia era of the church as we know it. And as John wrote at the end, he said, "He who testifies these things says, surely I am coming quickly." And I think we can see the quickly bit now. We're getting near the full stop there, aren't we? 1 year, 2 years, 3 years before all this comes crashing down. "Even so, come, Lord Jesus."